Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. BP is now testing that new temporary cap that it's placed on the blown well in the Gulf of Mexico. The cap's being called a great big faucet by one BP official, and the company hopes over the next day or two they can use it to turn off the flow of oil. In the meantime, oil drilling companies that successfully sued to stop the Obama administration's moratorium on offshore oil drilling are reviewing a revised moratorium from the White House. This one may also go back to the courts. Let's check in with Joel Achenbach of the Washington Post. Joel, first to that cap. What's called an integrity test is underway. What's supposed to happen?
Well, the integrity test, I mean, this is a really big moment, Robin, in this whole crisis. I mean, there's been a lot of big moments, but today is pins and needles for everyone because what they did last night is they put on this new cap, and the word cap doesn't really do justice to it. It's a huge structure that has all kinds of valves and things, and they lowered it onto the top of the blowout preventer, and they can actually shut in the well using this. They can just turn it off, essentially. They have not started the test yet. That should be really any minute or any hour now. We're waiting for that. When they do this, then everyone will see what happens. What happens when you shut the flow from the top? Will it just shut down the well, or will it cause more problems? Will there be leaks into the surrounding rock formation? Will we spring new leaks? So it's a big moment.
Right. Well, let's wait for that. But even if the flow of oil is turned off and there isn't some sort of stress that's created by that in another, as you said, sort of leak, this isn't considered the permanent solution. How are those relief wells going?
Well, there are two relief wells, and the first one is very close. I'm told it's 5 feet laterally from the well. It has another 30 feet downward to go. They'll set the final casing, steel casing, and then they'll make the final approach, another 30 feet or so, until they actually intercept the well. And, you know, how long will that take? I mean, this is all new territory for us as reporters. I mean, I think by the end of this month, they may actually be, poking around in there. But they have to get it exactly right. Remember, it's a very small target. The steel casing is 9 inches across. And inside that steel casing is a pipe that's 7 inches across. They've got to, you can't be a foot to the right or a foot to the left. Mm-hmm. So this is very painstaking work.
Well, Joel, just remind us how the new moratorium from the White House is different from the last moratorium. This is, again, on drilling that was turned down by the courts. And what's your sense that this new moratorium on drilling is going to end up with another court challenge?
Well, the only difference is, I mean, it's kind of a do-over. The first time they said you can't drill in deep water, this time I think they said you can't use these certain kinds of rigs, which happen to be the rigs you use in deep water. So it's almost a semantic difference with the same effect being desired, which is to keep these 33 deep water rigs from drilling new holes in the Gulf floor. I think that the industry is howling. At some point, they'll be saying, "Hey, if you don't let us do our thing out here, we'll pack up our toys and go off to Brazil or West Africa."
Well, Joel, I just want to jump in there because, as you know, the Presidential Commission investigating the Deepwater Horizon accident had its first meeting yesterday. The CEO of Diamond Offshore Drilling said that two deepwater rigs that had employed 150 people are moving abroad rather than waiting to hear what's going to happen with the new moratorium. And he said his employees were asking, "How come the auto industry gets bailed out, we get driven out?" This is a tough corner now for the White House.
Well, the auto industries, though, didn't spill millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, the oil industry has never been really super popular. Drilling is never really popular. And for a long time, one of the things the industry could say is, "Hey, look, we haven't had an accident, a big one since Santa Barbara in 1969. Well, they can't say that anymore. They all know in the industry, I've talked to oil executives, they know they have to come up with something that would persuade the public, we know what we're doing, we can stop a blowout, we can fix a problem, we'll do better next time. They have to persuade that. So in a way, yeah. It's not just a legal question. I mean, the industry has to come up with a plausible scenario for why they should be allowed to poke holes in the bottom of the deep Gulf of Mexico.
Joel Achenbach, a national reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, terrorism expert Jessica Stern has been a frequent guest on Here and Now. She's nationally acclaimed for her work. She's interviewed dozens of terrorists around the world. But she never got to interview her rapist, who killed himself in 2003. All right, obviously, we're about to enter an area that may not be appropriate for children, even though what happened to Jessica happened when she was a child, just 15. It also happened to her sister, who was 14, in bucolic Concord, Massachusetts. The police didn't believe they'd been raped. Her own family was in denial, a well-honed skill developed after her father's escape from Nazi Germany and then the shock of her mother's death from cancer when Jessica was just 3. Jessica's father wanted her and her sister to get over their rape. They seemed to. Then more than 3 decades later, Jessica discovers that the man who raped and tortured her and her sister was connected to over 40 rapes in the Boston area in the early 70s, with an M.O. so unique, anyone looking to connect the dots would have. Nobody did. Jessica finally does, and then she meets another woman who'd also been a victim of Dennis Meggs. Jessica Stern's new book is Denial, A Memoir of Terror. She joins us in the studio. Hello.
Thank you.
Also with us is Amy Vorenberg. Now, she's identified by the pseudonym Lucy in your book. Amy's now a professor of law at the Franklin Pierce Law School in New Hampshire. And Amy, you decided after the book was published in an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe to reveal your real name?
Yes, that's right. I made the decision to do it after really getting to know Jessica and reading the book and excerpts from the book and realizing that I could really do, you know, some good for mm-hmm. other victims. There was also a sense of outrage once the story unfolded for me that there were so many.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate your being here as well. And there's a moment in your book, Jessica, where you have this thought, too, maybe I could help other people. And then you say, you know, that's kind of grandiose. Really, when you get right down to it, what you really want to do is kill the guy.
Yeah. There were times when I absolutely wanted to kill the guy. And I must say that some men have trouble with that. But I think there's probably not a victim of sexual assault who doesn't have that feeling.
Yeah, but take us back to this time when it's just very difficult to read how rape was viewed then. You use notes that you discovered after you and someone who, it turns out, went to your high school, a detective who decides to reopen the case, and you decide you want to see the files. Do you mind just, as much as you want to, telling us a little bit about it?
Sure. A man came into the house with a gun, and then he asked us to show him a drawer with knives in it. Nothing came of that. And then he marched us to the top floor, and he wanted us to put on our little sister's clothing, and he wanted us to brush each other's hair and put on our stepmother's clothing. And then he raped us. But the whole time he was telling us that if we didn't do exactly what he said, he would kill us. Mm. And then at the end, he cocked his gun. I mean, we were
click.
Both click, the click of the gun.
Yeah.
And we were sure he was going to kill us. The question was whether he was going to kill one or both of us. And then, and this was part of his signature, he said it wasn't a real gun. It was a cap gun.
To people who don't understand, how could you forget a rape for 30 years, because you're constantly writing about things that you rediscover, you know, talking to police. I can hear them saying, how could that be possible?
Well, I didn't actually forget the rape. I forgot details of the rape.
Yeah.
And I also completely dissociated the feeling. And I would talk about the rape if I were asked. And people would say, oh, you're so strong. And because there was no emotion. But it wasn't that I was strong. It was that I was dissociated, and the details sort of disappeared.
Yeah. And so in writing the book, it's about, what, pulling that part of you that starts to float away, just trying to make that part of you stay.
Yes, to reattach the fact with the feeling.
It's horrifying, you know, to read about. It also, you can't help but think, this is what your life's work has been for several decades. People who tell you what it's like to have the gun at their head, to hear the click. As you're looking back and remembering this, because a lot of this you didn't remember, you put it aside, you split off from it, are you thinking, oh my God, and then I went into that work?
Yes. People are shocked that it wasn't obvious to me from the get-go that I was trying to tame some kind of evil. I was trying to understand some kind of evil, the nature of the perpetrator. Wasn't it clear to me? But it wasn't.
Well, and we're not just talking about you here. We're talking about your father, who was out of the country when this happened and didn't come home for 3 days.
I need to be clear that my father, it would have been hard for him to come home right away, and he didn't.
Logistically, yeah.
It was logistically quite difficult. And I think my father had a very hard time dealing with the rape, both in his not instantly returning, but then also I think imagining that my sister and I were over it 4 months later. I think it was just hard for him to take it in. My father's philosophy is stiff upper lip. When something bad happens, you focus on the future and you move on.
Like your relatives getting killed in the Holocaust and you being a young Jewish boy beaten up all the time and afraid that Nazis were going to kill you all the time.
Right. I mean, he did not want to be a victim. And I learned from him how not to be a victim. And I just blocked out what happened to me.
But it seems that because you have, I mean, the book is called Denial. You have it on every level. The police, your father, you, and obviously other families, because we, as we said, there are all these other cases, and nobody's going to TV stations and saying, hey, you know, there's a lot of this going on. So you have decades of this. Do you wonder what might have happened if people had talked?
That's why I think Amy is really telling a very important story, because in her case, it all happened within an 8-block area and nobody was talking about it. Harvard wasn't talking about it.
Let's bring back in Amy Vorenberg again, as we said, a professor of law at Franklin Pierce Law School up in New Hampshire. But Amy, just when you were raped, you were in a house filled with women, sort of smack in the middle of very busy Harvard Square. Did you or your family have any idea what was going on in the neighborhood?
No, we had no idea. And I think if my parents had had an idea, they would have taken even just minimal precautions.
Because how many reported attacks had there been when you were attacked?
I think I was the 12th one, and I don't remember exactly how many in the neighborhood, but there were all told 18, I think, in the neighborhood.
Your experience was a lot like Jessica's, but in other ways, it was very different. How did you feel embraced by family and friends after this happened, as opposed to being told it didn't happen or people being in denial?
Well, I think my family, my parents, were very much ahead of their time, but it took them about 8 seconds to realize the way to deal with this was not to push it under the rug, to make it clear to me that this was an act of violence. I was a victim of a crime, and helped me understand that this wasn't a shameful thing.
That's Amy Vorenberg, now a law professor, interestingly. She was raped when she was a little girl by the same serial rapist who attacked terrorism expert Jessica Stern when she was little. When we come back, how Jessica's research into all of this history has affected her work today. Also later today, new studies about the only child. It's a pretty good thing to be an only child. That's later. Back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with terrorism expert Jessica Stern, who writes about her rape and the rape of her sister when they were both young girls in Concord, Massachusetts. Her new book is called Denial. We're also joined by Amy Vorenberg, who's a professor of law at Franklin Pierce Law School in New Hampshire. She was assaulted by the same man Jessica was, but Amy's experience was one of being accepted by her family, being allowed to talk about what happened. And Jessica, that's very different from your experience. Your father, again, a Holocaust survivor. He was in denial. So Jessica, how did it feel for you to hear Amy's story?
You know, there are advantages to being raised the way I was raised. I think there are pros and cons. I mean, my dad, I think, was really raising his kids to survive a concentration camp. And we turned out pretty tough. But it was a gift for me to meet Amy. I actually had never talked to a victim of rape before, and I'm not sure I would have been able to handle it if Amy were somebody who had been destroyed by the experience. She's very successful, and professionally and personally, and it felt okay that we could be victims together because we were both thriving.
Be survivors together,
yeah.
Yeah.
I was fortunate that Amy was kind of in the same place that I was. She was ready. She really wanted to learn who this guy was. She wanted to get access to her file. She wanted to know what had happened. And I think for all of the victims, it is a great relief to know that he's dead.
He killed himself. But Amy, I'm wondering too, and I asked Jessica the same thing, because of Jessica's dogged, investigation and digging, we find out that this was a very sick man, possibly mentally ill, and maybe also abused. He lived in an area where there were tons of Catholic Church scandals. Did you worry about risking feeling for him at all?
I can't answer the question now whether I do or I don't. I don't know whether I have compassion for him. I have sort of no feeling at all about him, which may be part of the trauma response, similar to what Jessica describes.
Yeah. And Jessica, I'm wondering about you, as you find out these things about him.
My feelings about him change. I will tell you that right now, sitting here, I have no compassion, even though I think it's extremely likely that he was abused by a priest or perhaps more than one. He did so much damage.
Have you heard from other women?
We have. Amy and I have, since her op-ed appeared and since the summary of my book has appeared, and now the book, we are getting emails from other victims. One woman who was at Tufts, one on the Cape, one in Danvers. I just heard from one, the friend of one who, in Weston, yes.
And are these survivors of your attacker's attacks, or
very likely. I'm hearing from dozens of victims of rape, yeah. But I'm just listing now the ones that seem very likely to be the same perpetrator.
And Amy, how do you feel this whole experience has changed you?
Having met Jessica and have her in my life is just an incredible gift. I mean, I can echo what she says. It's amazing to meet somebody who's been through something virtually identical, I mean, in so many ways. But also to meet somebody who's been through it and also is thriving, because I think I feel the way she does, is that's important. It's that you meet somebody who's been through it and it didn't take them down. What shocks me more than anything, I think every time I think about this fact, that I was raped on March 15th, and on the next night in my neighborhood, there were two more by the same guy. In the same neighborhood. So that shocks me, but what shocks me even more is that it's actually something that you think, oh, well, that was then, this is now. It's still kind of going on. It's still part of our culture that we allow this kind of crime to get pushed under the rug for whatever reason, whether it's publicity or discomfort or whatever. But it's still going on.
Jessica Stern, how has this whole experience going on this journey, how has this changed, informed your work with terrorism?
I think it's made me less afraid of the emotional aspect, but perhaps more importantly, I am now aware of the potential importance of the frequent rape of little boys by Afghan military and police commanders, and also the sexual abuse of boys at Pakistani madrasas. I've known about the abuse of the boys at the madrasas for many, many years, and I never thought before that it could potentially be one element of the humiliation that the jihadis talk about. And I was afraid to put these things together, and now I hope that somebody will investigate the extent to which that kind of humiliation is playing a role in the rise of jihadi terrorism in Southwest Asia.
You know, when you were just talking about the Pakistani boys, one last thing. I saw emotion in your face that I'm not used to seeing in your face. Jessica Stern is the one who comes in and matter-of-factly talks about the most horrible things, whether it's Abu Ghraib or Daniel Pearl. And I just saw something in you I don't normally see. And I'm wondering, do you think you can continue this work since maybe part of that disassociation helped you do it?
I think the disassociation was absolutely critical to the work, and I won't be able to go back to the field to expose myself to danger in the way I once did. I'm still talking to terrorists, but only when they're incarcerated or it's completely safe. I think that having emotion could actually get in the way of the work.
Yeah, but it's better for life.
Yes, it's better for life, yes.
Amy, Jessica, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Terrorism expert Jessica Stern. Her book is Denial, A Memoir of Terror. We also spoke with Amy Vorenberg, who appears in Jessica's book under the pseudonym Lucy. She's now a professor of law at Franklin Pierce Law School in New Hampshire. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org, and you can read an excerpt of Jessica's book there as well, hereandnow.org. Latest news is next. A government investigation is underway in Ireland after the news that nearly 200 children in state care died in the past 10 years. The investigation will determine whether the Irish health authorities failed to protect the children and what that might mean for the thousands of other children now under state care in Ireland. The BBC's Audrey Carville reports.
We do know Daniel was murdered, and we do hope that the people that did murder Daniel are brought to justice.
On February 25th this year, Daniel McAnaspey ran away from his temporary accommodation here in North Dublin to join his friends for a party. A fight broke out, and the next time his sister saw him, he was dead.
It's very, very sad, but in a way we're glad to have him back so we can put him to rest and say goodbye to him properly.
Daniel was put into the care of the state when he was 10 years old. His father had died, his mother couldn't cope and had become an alcoholic. But Daniel's life was to become even more chaotic as the health authorities failed to find him a permanent home. There have been others, David Foley, Danny Talbot, Michelle Bray, just three out of 187 teenagers who died while they were in the care of the state. The chief executive of the children's charity Barnardo's is Fergus Finlay.
I know a young girl at the moment in a suicidal condition, a girl who spent her life in care and who is being cared for by people outside the system because the system isn't in a position to respond to her needs. I went to a funeral within the last 6 months of a boy called Danny Talbot who fell outside the system when he passed his 18th birthday and was dead a few months later from a drug overdose. So I'm afraid Daniel McAnaspey isn't alone, and I really do worry that if we don't get our act together, we're going to see more of them.
The Health Service Executive, or HSE, is responsible for the care of vulnerable children. But in the cases of at least two dead teenagers, it was accused by a government-appointed inquiry of failing to protect them and providing a chaotic system of care. The HSE representative I spoke to would not comment directly on any of the individual cases. This was Bernard Glaster's response when I put it to him that many families felt that they had been failed by the state.
The death of a child is one of the most tragic events that a family will experience. We can only endeavour to empathise with those families and to assure them that we would look at every aspect of our practice and our service to continue to make it better and to continue to be open to the possibility that perhaps we could have done things differently.
The situation does justify using the word crisis, because that's exactly what it is. It's a crisis for the children, it's a crisis for the social workers, and it's a crisis for management.
Last year, these social workers risked their jobs to describe just how chaotic their work is. They didn't want to be identified for a television investigation, so their words are spoken by actors.
We're just firefighting. We're just responding to crisis after crisis after crisis, and that's what we're reduced to.
If the ordinary Irish parents who care about their children saw what happened to the children in the system, they would be appalled, because everybody wants to protect their children, and we as a state didn't.
Failing to protect children in Ireland is nothing new. It's just over a year since Judge Sean Ryan published a devastating report cataloguing 40 years of sexual and physical abuse of thousands of children in care by priests, nuns and religious brothers. It's a different kind of abuse today, but according to Fergus Finlay of Barnardo's, children are still second-class citizens here. That's why he wants a referendum on children's rights.
In effect, I suppose it would be moving us from the history that we have, where children were supposed to be seen and not heard, to a situation where children would have to, by law, be listened to. That's not a panacea, but it would be a fundamental symbolic step, and over time it would have a profound impact in law and in administration.
Here in North Dublin, Daniel McInaspy's family are still grieving. They are angry and they want answers from the people who were meant to protect their vulnerable 17-year-old brother.
3 weeks before Daniel went missing, I had a meeting and they told me Daniel was a street boy. I told them, no, Daniel's going to be hurt, and they would not listen to us. Maybe if they had of, we've lost Daniel, and I blame these people. If they had of just listened to us, Daniel would be still here today.
That report from the BBC's Audrey Carville in Dublin. Okay, how about some good news for kids and parents? New studies show the only child fares pretty well, is happy and adjusted, but gets a bad rap because of some 19th century psychologist. We want to hear that story in 30 seconds, here and now. One side effect of the recession could be that families are having fewer children. The Guttmacher Institute found 64% of women say they can't afford to have another child. 44% say they plan to put off having another child or have fewer kids. But there's something else going on. Since the early 60s, long before the recent market crash, the National Center for Health Statistics found that single-child families have almost doubled to about 1 in 5. What does this mean for the only child, for the parents, for society? Time magazine took a look in this week's cover story, The Only Child Myth. Reporter Lauren Sandler, an only child herself and the mom of an only child, wrote the story. And Lauren, start with your title, because you found that there was actually a moment in history when a myth started that only children were supposed to be selfish and spoiled and lonely.
You got it. It's interesting. The journalist Bill McKibben writes about the origins of this myth as seeing the birth of the star, almost, that, you know, it's so rare to see the birth of a prejudice in that moment. And it did, in fact, happen when a study was published around 1896 by a man named Granville Stanley Hall, who was one of the fathers of the child study movement here in the States. But he was also a man who was raised in rural Massachusetts and loved tumbling around the farm like puppies with all of his siblings, and had a real prejudice himself against only children, and found that, in his words, being an only child was a disease in and of itself.
A disease. He found that these children were peculiar, overprivileged, asocial, self-centered, aloof. Well, and from there, it just took off. But you, on the contrary, find that science, modern science, finds something very different. You spoke with Toni Falbo from the University of Texas in Austin. She's studied only children. What did she find?
Well, it's interesting. There has been research by many social scientists going back decades and decades now showing that there really isn't that much of a difference between only children and their counterparts with siblings. In fact, the only places in which difference can be measured usually is in terms of self-esteem and achievement, in which only children actually score higher. So what Toni Falbo did at the University of Texas is she set out to prove the stereotype. That was the experiment that she was working with, where the notion of the only child is lonely, selfish, and maladjusted was something that she was examining through a meta-analysis of hundreds of studies. And in the end, she basically found that it held no water and that it's a prejudice that we've been living with for years.
Well, and we should say that, you know, you're an only child yourself, the mother of one, and you feel pretty good about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a good ride with it, I must say. I'm sure that there are some people who would attribute some of the qualities of only children to me. I do tend to be precocious and pretty independent, but these are things that I've never found to be issues about myself. They're just part of who I am, in the same way that if I had grown up with siblings, they would shape me too. It's really a question of whether we're worse off.
Right.
And the culture tells us that we are. And in fact, I'm not sure that that's so true.
Well, and by the way, I'm sure we're going to hear from kids who are only children who said, I was lonely. We're sure that there is that aspect. But what you found in your research is that only children tended to be more attended to, that maybe they did better in testing, for instance, because all of the efforts of the family went into that child.
That's true. And I think that the loneliness question is, you know, one of the most sort of visceral aspects of our anxiety about only children, that we see someone alone and we assume that they're lonely. And there's a psychologist in Texas named Carl Pickhart who said something really interesting to me, which is that only children actually have the most developed primary relationship with themselves of any kids because they have to. And so it's funny, you know, we're all lonely. I think that loneliness is just simply a part of the human condition, and some of us feel it more than others. But when you have the narrative of growing up as a singleton, it's easy to attribute that loneliness to that quality of your life.
Yeah. Well, and now what does having one child do for the parents? And this comes to, it sounds like one of the reasons you did the article, because you, like many parents, are struggling to figure out, do you want to have another child? And you spoke to many parents who were very honest with you, and they said, you know, I'm not sure we can afford it.
Well, I think it's a complicated thing. I think that right now, especially, a lot of parents feel like they can't afford it financially. But I also feel that outside of the recession, it's something that a lot of people feel like they can't necessarily afford in terms of their time, their emotional energy, the sacrifices they want to make in their lives. And I think that parents of only children get a really bad rap for being selfish. But I also think that in modern society, you know, we owe it to ourselves to decide what we want.
Well, and that idea that people who limit their amount of children to one child, and by the way, we're talking about people who can have other children. You know, we know some people, you know, try and can't. You know, the society does label them as selfish, and you raise the question, is there a little bit of that? Because society does need to reproduce itself to carry on. As you note, Europe is struggling with a drop in population. You raise questions like, who will supply the workforce? Who will take care of the elderly?
Yeah, I mean, it really is an issue that economists and demographers seem to be feeling a lot of panic about. Though it's hard to find anyone who would say, yes, I'm going to have another child for the sake of France. You know, I mean, it's just not how we make those choices. And I think that in different cultures, we make those choices differently. For example, the researcher Tony Falbo, who you mentioned in Texas, talks about how American parents choose to have children because it's what they connect with happiness, whereas Chinese parents choose to have children because it's what they connect with success. I mean, we have all of these norms when it comes to making this incredibly personal and complicated choice.
And people used to have children because they needed someone to work the farm.
Oh, yeah. Work the farm, mind the store, take care of the elderly.
Yeah.
That's just not what our society is now. And it was for so long that, you know, there are many people who would claim that we are hardwired, that evolutionary biology is responsible for this. And indeed, you know, the desire to have intercourse is so wrapped up in this. But I think that if we are going to be honest about what we want our lives to look like, we need to shift this conversation a little bit. And if we're balancing the notion that only children are disturbed with the notion that we need to be sacrificing so much of what we want from our adulthood to make them less disturbed by giving them siblings, and if there's no science behind that, I just think it's time to step back and reevaluate that conversation.
Lauren Sandler, who wrote Time Magazine's cover story, The Only Child Myth, debunking the myth that there's something wrong with only kids. She concludes the kids are all right. But Lauren, what did you decide? Because part of this is your own exploration of the question, should you have a second child?
I mean, it's tough. I'm 35. I have a 2.5-year-old. Most of my friends right now are pregnant with their second kids. It's definitely on my mind. Now feels like it's the moment. And I have to say, I haven't totally decided yet. I can see why people have more children. I'm so in love with my child at the stage that she's at now that I can imagine wanting to have that experience again, wanting to see her develop a relationship with a sibling. There's a lot that I want, but there are other things that I want from my life too. And so it's something I'm going to be weighing in the coming years.
Well, we wish you the best with it. Again, Lauren Sandler of Time Magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Are you still looking for a book to take to the beach and maybe the latest vampire doorstop doesn't float your boat, it sinks it? Well, maybe suggest Beowulf. That was just one of Jack Murnaghan's suggestions. He also thinks that Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past or James Joyce's Ulysses can be page turners if you know what to look for. Jack has a doctorate in medieval and Renaissance literature from Duke University. He's the author of Beowulf on the Beach, What to Love and What to Skip in Literature's 50 Greatest Hits. We spoke with him last summer when his book first came out, and I began by pointing out that his list includes a lot of books that nobody really reads anymore. Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, Kafka's The Trial, or George Eliot's Middlemarch.
It is true, and it's sort of sad. That's why I wrote this book, to try to reorient people away from magazines and lesser fiction and try to get them to read some really good things that will surprise them.
And everybody has different opinions of the list. So, for instance, I completely understand Tolstoy's Anna Karenina or Nabokov's Lolita. But Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, it's in 14th century English. Our producer, Emiko Tamagawa, is one of legions who had to memorize the opening lines of the Canterbury Tales, I think, Emiko, 20 years ago, and she still remembers them. Let's listen.
One that April with his shurus sought, the droot of March hath pierced to the rot, and bothered every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor.
Not all the Canterbury Tales are going to be especially fun to read at this point, but some of them might surprise you as being among the funniest and maybe even sexiest things that you've ever read. You read something like The Wife of Bath, and she talks about how she's put 5 husbands in the grave by having too much sex with them, and that she just wants to have a young one who stays fresh in the bed, always gives her what she wants, and that she's going to have dominion over him by allotting out how much pleasure he's allowed to have. Kind of feminist, kind of modern, right?
Well, and it also is like the part of the book that someone might want to get to real fast, and so...
Indeed, yes, and you're allowed to skip some of the religious sermons. I let you know which pages those are so you can bypass those.
Well, yes, you have these different segments. They're a guide to what to look for. One of the segments is what's sexy in a book. So, for instance, in Madame Bovary, the erotic description of sweat on Emma Bovary's shoulders. Quirky Facts is another segment. Of Kafka, you write that he died at 40 of starvation, of illnesses that made his throat so sore he couldn't swallow. And as you write, that's awful. And another thing that you let us in on, though, is what to skip. And in Moby Dick, for instance, that would be pretty much all the chapters on whaling.
No. Only a little bit. Only a tiny bit.
Okay. Well, but what do you say to those who say even that is heresy? You know, every word of a great book should be read.
I hope those people don't have children that they're ignoring or lovers that they're not listening to or other things that they're not tending to because, I read all these books and I read them multiple times and very, very carefully, but it takes a long, long time and you can't expect people with normal lives and normal jobs to be able to read, say, all 3,300 pages of the Proust. But if you read 1,800 pages of the Proust, you're going to get an enormous, enormous treat.
And Beowulf. Isn't very long, but it's a long time ago. The group of Dark Age Scandinavians assaulted night after night by the monster Grendel. As you write, every morning they find more men dead in the mead hall. Tell us the appeal of Beowulf.
Beowulf is just one of the studliest books of all time. It's very short. It's only 70 pages. It has incredible action scenes. It's an expression of an incredibly macho culture. So you read it, and it's just all about how fate will take you, brother. You are a warrior now, but later... age will come in and grayness of hair and dimness of eye and then you will be taken. It's just macho. And you read it and you're like, wow, our blood has thinned a little bit since then.
Okay, well, we'll give it a try. Milton's Paradise Lost, because as you say, Milton's epic tale of Satan's rebellion, the creation of the world, the fall of man, and his deliverance by Christ is the greatest single prodigy of a human pen.
If you read it, and it takes a while, and if you understand what Milton is doing with his poetry, with the setup, with the religious sentiments behind the poem, you see it's just a staggering achievement. The writing is so powerful. The story is so meaningful. Satan is often confused to be the hero because he's portrayed so sympathetically.
Well, we have a reading of some of Satan's most famous lines from Milton's Paradise Lost. Let's listen.
The mind is its own place and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I be still the same? And what I should be, all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater, here at least we shall be free. The Almighty hath not built here for his envy, will not drive us hence. Here we may reign secure, and in my choice to reign is worth ambition, though in hell. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
But at the end of the day, what Milton wants to say is, we all have many, many tendencies that would make us recreate either Satan's fall or Adam and Eve's fall. And we need to be reminded that those are not the things that you do to get yourself to heaven, and that true piety comes in a different form. It comes in selflessness. It comes in lack of ego. Of course, he was about as egotistic as any human being on the planet. So,
well, in fact, that's really an interesting tidbit there. You write, in the history of man, John Milton might well have been the biggest jerk.
You know, he was smarter, more arrogant, and more probably uptight than, you know, perhaps anybody of his century.
We mentioned Paradise Lost. You feel it's the greatest single prodigy of a human pen. But as you say, some say Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace is just the world's greatest novel, period, but it looks like half a loaf of pumpernickel and weighs about twice as much. How do you make your way through War and Peace?
Oh, rapturously. Honestly, it's not that hard to read. There are a few sections that are a little tedious, some stuff on theory of history and maybe a little bit too much detail about some of the battles, although some of them are incredible. But ultimately, what you see with both Anna Karenina and War and Peace is that Tolstoy is pretty easygoing. He's never obscure. The language is never that difficult, but it's just a steady, slow, rapturous process reading him. And what War and Peace does more than any other novel is have its characters transform, have its characters develop spiritual epiphanies. And to be able to go along with that process and feel them in their full weight is really an incredible thing.
Then there's 100 Years of Solitude, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Here's a little of the beginning.
Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. At that time, Moconato was a village of 20 adobe houses, built on the bank of a river of clear water that ran along a bed of polished stones which were white and enormous, like prehistoric eggs. The world was so recent that many things lacked names, and in order to indicate them, it was necessary to point.
Here you just seem to not be able to find the words to say how great you think this book is, a novel that arches above and beyond all others, covering them in its eclipse like a sequoia does a sapling. This book reaches me where I zip, where I button a shirt, where I put on a hat. There's no book that can teach us more. Why?
Oh, because it's just so full of humanity and so full of life and wisdom. Its characters are incredibly deep and incredibly moving, and just even though they all share the same names, they have a really profound range. So you'll find people in such a range of human situations responding at the deepest level of feeling and wisdom. I just think that it's an incredible document about being alive and being a human being.
So Jack, there are 50. I'm looking, the Fairy Queen, Faust 1 and 2, Bleak House, To the Lighthouse. Pick five.
The five that I think you're going to get the most out of would be 100 Years of Solitude, War and Peace, Moby Dick, Bleak House, and Paradise Lost.